Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. April 22nd is Earth Day, and in recognition of that event, Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik will be talking to Linda Lear about the life of Rachel Carson and her contributions to our knowledge of the environment in which we live. But before that, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1947, professional baseball took one step closer to becoming the national pastime. It was on April 15th of that year when Jackie Robinson slipped into a Brooklyn Dodgers uniform and became modern baseball's first black major league player. Chosen as much for his interpersonal communication skills, formal education, and experience before large audiences, Robinson was not only supposed to help the Dodgers win pennants, but to break down many of the racial barriers that kept blacks out of the National League. As it turned out, it was a good choice. But before he had a chance to prove himself on the diamond, fans and fellow players attempted to root him back to the Negro Leagues where they thought he belonged. On the field, he was taunted by crowds, spiked by fellow players, and abused with racial slurs, while off the field he faced death threats and was subjected daily to segregated public accommodations. All the while, Robinson kept his focus and dignity, and in doing so broke through athletic, racial, and social barriers, becoming one of the most respected men to ever play the game. Turning to items of interest in the news, historians are lining up on different sides of a curious historical debate involving the service of African Americans in the Confederate Army of the Civil War. While the role of blacks in the Union's struggle against the South has been clearly researched and popularized in recent books and movies, some now seek equal recognition for those who fought on the other side. Such recognition has been staunchly opposed by both blacks and whites in recent years, as it conflicts with more popular understandings about why the war was fought. Supporters of the growing movement feel that the honest recognition of black Confederates might help to heal historical racial divisions in the South. And 143 years ago after her death, Manuela Sainz is once again stealing hearts, this time with the people of South America. Sainz, the mistress of Latin America's great liberator, Simón Bolívar, has recently become the focus of attention as one of the continent's greatest heroines. Liberated, intelligent, and of considerable political influence, Sainz was for a long time condemned as an adulterous lover of a demigod. But as Bolivar's reputation rebounded, opposition waned, and writers, painters, and historians placed signs at the center of the revolution that freed Latin America from Spanish rule. You're listening to Talking History. No one has made a greater contribution to our knowledge of the environment and man's abuse of the environment than Rachel Carson. So it's appropriate that our special Earth Day show be devoted to Carson. Here to interview our special guest and authority on her is Creighton historian Dennis Mihalik. Dennis?
Thank you, Brian. With the Earth Day celebration soon upon us, today's program will explore the life and work of Rachel Carson, a giant in the field of environmentalism. Our guest is Linda Lear, research professor of environmental history at George Washington University and the author of the book, Rachel Carson, Witness for Nature, published by Henry Holt and Company, and also the author of Lost Woods, the Discovered Writings of Rachel Carson, available from the Beacon Press. Welcome, Professor Lear.
Thank you, Dennis. Nice to be with you.
You and others have compared Rachel Carson and her book, Silent Spring, to Harriet Beecher Stowe and Uncle Tom's Cabin. Why did Carson's book create such an instant controversy?
Well, you have to remember that this was the book appeared in 1962, which was really a very brief time after the war ended. This was the period of the Cold War, and Americans are very comfortable and satisfied and trying to get on with their lives. And thinking that things in their world were pretty good. And along comes a woman scientist, female scientist, and tells them that their world is not as they think it is, that in fact it is poisoned, and that it can get worse, and defended that thesis. defended it so well that the public knew, because she had a reputation of telling the truth, that there must be something serious going on that they should look into.
Mm-hmm. Now, specifically in Silent Spring, what was her thesis? What point was she arguing?
Well, she was arguing that if that government and government scientists and the scientific establishment had used a new technology, namely chemical pesticides, DDT and others, in ways that were not only ineffective and inefficient, but absolutely harmful for the whole biota, harmful for the soil, harmful to the water, harmful to fish, harmful to birds, wildlife, and up the food chain, harmful to human beings, and in ways that might not be known for unborn generations. This was her thesis, that it was being misused. It was a good technology, but it was being misused.
Mm-hmm. And how did she go about proving her case, I mean, scientifically?
Well, some people think Carson didn't prove the case. It's amazing how much it's still being debated. But she basically went about proving it by an incredible amount of research on the secondary level. Carson was not a researcher in a laboratory. Taking the research that others had recently done and had been known for quite a while, putting it down as an indictment of the scientists that were using these applications against the other scientists who were saying, you better not do this.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was her training to go about doing this kind of secondary research and then writing?
Well, Carson was a scientist. She had majored in biology after starting out as a writer at Pennsylvania College for Women, which is now Chatham College in Pittsburgh. She was one of the very few women who went into science in the late 20s. She graduated in 1929. And went on to Johns Hopkins University, where she earned a degree in marine biology, again being one of very few women. She joined the Fish and Wildlife Service in the mid-30s after, again, trying to decide whether she was going to make her way as a writer or make her way as a scientist. It was the middle of the Depression, and jobs were hard to come by, and she was very fortunate. And also very well-deserved because she was brilliant and had scored brilliantly on the government tests. So she found a job in the government and rose through the ranks of the Fish and Wildlife Service, or what is now the Fish and Wildlife Service, to become editor-in-chief of all publications for that organization.
Mm-hmm. And so she was working in Washington, D.C.?
She worked in Washington, D.C. She started out in field offices in Baltimore and then worked in Washington, D.C., in Maine Interior.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned, she is a woman in the pre-women's liberation era, operating in science and in a bureaucracy largely filled by men. How well accepted was she?
Well, it was interesting. Carson was accepted in the 30s and 40s and 50s. She resigned from the service in 1952 in order to write full-time after the publication of The Sea Around Us in 1951, which made her internationally famous. She was accepted largely because, as an editor, she was not in competition with other male scientists for rank or privilege or position. Rather, she was doing what was deemed acceptable women's work. So unlike some of the other early women in government and high positions, she was quite accepted. What she did was review other people's research, and it's because of that position, being an editor, that she sat in the interior and saw the research from all the refuges and all the laboratories coming across her desk and was asked to edit it and check it and double-check it. And it's through this means of knowing what all the scientists were doing, that she first got wind of the problem with DDT.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that she had already gained international fame through the publication of a book, The Sea Around Us?
That's right. The Sea Around Us was a blockbuster book. Carson wrote 3 books about the sea. She is considered the biographer of the sea. It began with her first book, Under the Sea Wind, which was published in 1941 just as the war broke out. It's probably her most beautiful book of nature writing. And but it was not terribly well received at the time because the war broke out. It was republished later in 1952, and it too was on the bestseller list. But The Sea Around Us appeared in 1951 and was on the bestseller list for a record 86 weeks and sold internationally, published in 27 languages around the world. It was a remarkable book. And the last book was called The Edge of the Sea, which was a study of the shoreline and its creatures and its ecology.
Mm-hmm. And did it do well as the others?
It did well as well. It was also on the bestseller list between number 2 and 3 for, again, a record period of time. And all of Carson's books except the first one were serialized in The New Yorker, which we have to remember then was a magazine that reached the real intelligentsia and was considered probably the finest literary magazine in America. So to be serialized there was a great coup.
Mm-hmm. And now, in a book like The Sea Around Us that is so popular, I mean, is this a literary description or is this heavy science?
This is science for the public, which is what Carson wrote. She wanted to, her mission in life, if we can describe it as such, as a literary creature, was to inform the public about the world of science that they saw around them but didn't know about. And the ocean, of course, is something that fascinated her and fascinates almost everybody who goes near it. And she wanted to describe what the ocean was about. And so it's both scientific, but it's beautifully written. It's also poetry.
Mm-hmm. So how do we go from 3 books about the sea to Silent Spring?
Well, we go there because Carson's passion for the living world. What she was in love with was nature. And when she discovered that what she loved most in the world was being damaged, and perhaps damaged irrevocably, she had to pick up her pen and take on a subject which was certainly not beautiful as the sea and was distasteful in many ways. But she succeeded in Silent Spring in also making it a literary book, not a scientific treatise, mm-hmm. and making it a book about life.
Ah, and so then what's the message of her title, Silent Spring?
The fact that if we continue to use pesticides at such a rate and in such a volume that we won't have any springs. The birds will have died and the groundwater will have been contaminated, and there will not be a spring as we know it.
Mm-hmm. And she was able to compile this thesis from a series of scientific tracts that she had been editing?
Well, no. After she found out about the problem, and she'd already resigned from government at that point.
Okay.
Then she went on. It took her 5 years to write Silent Spring, mm-hmm. and 4 of those years were years in which she spent doing research, interviewing people, talking to people. This was very new science. What she was really doing was putting together as a synthesizer the science that was out there but that no one had ever put together. And it was putting it together that was so explosive, because it's in that synthesis that she discovers the links between chemical pesticides, for example, and the possibilities of human cancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, I mean, is there, is she part of an ongoing movement from, say, where we learn in the textbooks of standard U.S. history, Theodore Roosevelt and the conservation movement? Is Rachel Carson at the other end of some goalposts here?
Yes, I think so. She certainly is she spans the tradition of the early conservationists, but moves beyond them because her interest is in the whole of ecology. She's interested in how nature is linked together, and she sees it as a holistic web, and that you and insists that you cannot harm one thing or change one thing without causing change in other parts of nature. So she takes the concerns that the early conservationists had and then takes them to a new and higher level.
Mm-hmm. And from the textbooks, we know that T.R. was a blustery kind of individual, yet as I read, you called Rachel Carson, quote, an unlikely revolutionary, unquote.
Yes, she was a very gentle person, rather reticent. I wouldn't call her shy, but certainly reticent. She never sought the public. She was a writer, and that's what she loved to do. She wasn't a public activist ever. She was very politically informed, and she was a very good bureaucrat when she worked in the government, but she was not, had never sought an activist voice. And yet she found herself in the middle of a swirling controversy. She was a very gentle, feminine woman, and I don't think that she would have chosen for herself any sort of a public role, and yet she was thrust in it and carried it nobly.
Mm-hmm. Now, Rachel Carson did not live to see the movement she spawned. You think that she would not have become a political crusader in the environmental movement that sprung up from her work?
No, I don't think she. I don't think she would have ever have chosen to be a crusader again, but she certainly would have been a voice as a touchstone, if one could make that metaphor, for the environmental movement. Carson was not somebody who wanted or sought the public light. She would have written, she would have used her talent to further the aims of the environmental movement, but she couldn't have been an activist, as we know activism in the late 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm. So what, Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring, and then virtually within a year or so, she died?
Just 18 months, she was dead.
Mm-hmm. From?
Age 56, from misdiagnosed breast cancer.
Okay. Now, your subtitle your descriptions in your biography, you describe her as a witness for nature. In the minute or so that we have to sum up Rachel Carson, what would you say her literary and/or scientific legacy is?
I think her literary and scientific legacy is our own individual environmental consciousness. When Carson first sounded the alarm about pesticides, the American public did not know that chemical pesticides were poisonous. They did not know they were toxic. Rachel Carson told us correctly and gave us a chance to do something about that. And I think that none of us can use chemicals today without thinking twice about what we're doing. None of us can pollute today without thinking about what we're doing, and that's Rachel Carson's legacy.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's all the time that we have. I want to thank today's guest, Professor Linda Lear, author of Rachel Carson, Witness for Nature, as well as Lost Woods, the discovered writings of Rachel Carson that she has edited.
Earth Day is now 29 years old, but just what have we learned from our 29 celebrations of the day? Just how successful an event has it been in making Americans more aware of the fragility of their environment? Here to give us his perspective on that subject is Joseph Taylor, who teaches environmental history at Iowa State University. Taylor has written extensively on the fisheries of the western U.S. and Canada. His book, Making Salmon, An Environmental History of the Northwest Fisheries Crisis, will be published this fall by the University of Washington Press.
29 years ago, Dennis Hayes inspired Americans from all walks of life to transcend their differences for the sake of nature. On that April morning in 1970, Earth Day signaled a hopeful flowering of environmental awareness. Looking back, we can smirk at the naivete or mourn the lost hope of our parents and younger selves, but we would do well not to file away the past so simplistically. The history of Earth Day offers important lessons about the complex reality of environmentalism. Hayes achieved a remarkable degree of consensus in 1970, but he could not sustain it. In the years since, environmental enthusiasm has waned and waxed and waned like a broken-down boxer. Americans still respond to the bell, but we do not all hear the same signal. We discriminate between just and unjust causes based on many factors, and unanimity is rare. Thus, we must consider events in context to understand why consensus emerged and then evaporated. 1970 was a special moment. Hayes called it our last chance, but not all Americans agreed. Asphyxiating smog, burning rivers, scarred forests, and a weeping ironized Cody worried many Americans. But Earth Day also celebrated accomplishments. In the previous decade, Congress had mandated clean air and clean water, protected endangered species, and established wilderness areas. The very diversity of these impulses, encompassing as they did both the fears and hopes of rich and poor, urban and rural alike, enhanced the possibility of consensus. Yet such diversity also ensured that consensus would not last. Although most Americans support some brand of environmentalism, we relate to nature in ways that are often inimical to one another. Environmentalism is thus less a unifying cause than a rubric linking many competing causes, and our divergent interests conspire against the possibility of another moment of consensus. The history of environmentalism since Earth Day thus tells us much about the limits of common cause in this country. Americans are able to unite for special celebrations or against common enemies, but such unions are usually ephemeral. We fracture easily, and environmentalists have proven no more homogeneous than any other group of Americans. The first Earth Day was a special moment, but it passed. Since then, environmentalism has matured like progressivism, civil rights, feminism, and other movements. Nuances have emerged which differentiate and divide, and environmentalists now operate in a context significantly different from 1970. Americans would do well to remember these points when invoking memories of the first Earth Day. The past can still teach and inspire, but its lessons are not easily categorized.
You've been listening to Joseph Taylor, author of Making Salmon, An Environmental History of the Northwest Fisheries Crisis, to be published this fall by the University of Washington Press. This is Talking History. Following up on our interview with Linda Lear on Rachel Carson, we've chosen as our site of the week the Rachel Carson Homestead. Here to tell you more about the homestead is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Located about a half hour from Pittsburgh, the Rachel Carson Homestead in Springdale, Pennsylvania, is the birthplace and childhood home of the famous ecologist. The area surrounding the five-room farmhouse is where her love and respect for nature that would guide her through life grew. Tours are offered every Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and on Sundays from 1 to 5 p.m. The homestead also offers classes for children and adults and school and outreach programs, among others, many of which are offered year-round, including a Science on Saturday series. Also, May 22nd is Rachel Carson Day, the annual celebration of Carson's birthday, which includes family activities, open house tours, and entertainment. For more information, go to the Rachel Carson website at rachelcarson.org on the web for more information about the homestead and other related exhibits.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, news of recently opened or future films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else of a historical nature that may interest you. First, we call your attention to Pacific Arcadia. Images of California from 1600 to 1915, an exhibit scheduled to open on April 20th at the Cantor Art Center at Stanford University. Pacific Arcadia juxtaposes paintings, maps, prints, photographs, and advertisements in a presentation of the idealized portrait of California, the California Dream, that embodied the aspirations of those who had a stake in its development from the days of the Spanish explorers to the urban developers of the early 20th century. For more information on Pacific Arcadia, contact the Cantor Arts Center at Stanford University in Stanford, California. And if you happen to be in Independence, Missouri before May 31st, drop by the Truman Library and Museum to see the new exhibit, Time and the Presidency. Time and the Presidency spotlights the office of the presidency from Franklin Roosevelt to the present by drawing upon the archives of Time magazine. For more information, contact the Truman Museum in Independence, Missouri. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our show on the Berlin Airlift. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Nature's weekend.